Okay, well, welcome to the last talk in our Arts and Science Research Talk Series this year. We have the pleasure of welcoming Martin Connors from the Center for Science, who's talking about Northern Lights with 5 Satellites, a New Dimension in Auroral Studies. And he comments that his first summer job was in space physics, even though at the time he didn't know what it was. He got his BSc honors in applied mathematics at, what is UWO? You're going to have to tell me.
University of Western Ontario.
There you go. You're at Western, at University of Western Ontario, and his master's and PhD at the U of Alberta. He's worked in space in the Space Science Laboratory there before getting his PhD, a tutor since 1988. He's been with us a long time. He came on faculty in 1996 and became a Canada Research Chair in 2002. He took advantage of Athabasca's ideal location and to found the Athabasca University Geophysical Observatory in 2002 also. And I have to remind us once again that according to FOIP regulations, I have to remind everyone that this session is being recorded so that people can access it in the future from the website. Thanks, and I'll turn it over to Martin.
Thank you very much. I guess people can hear me, so if anybody has poor audio, please signal in some way. So basically, well, I see a happy face. I guess that means that you can hear me. okay, so recently there have been some very important developments in the study of the Northern Lights, and many of those have to do with the Themis satellite, or set of satellites, which is in fact 5 satellites. And the first picture on the title slide is the 5 Themis satellites, of which you can clearly see 3 on their launch assembly, all to be launched at the one time, which happened last February. That is a year ago February, in February 2007. They attained their final orbit this winter so that they were well set up, and I'll show what well set up means for doing studies of the Northern Lights. If you're attentive, you might notice there are apparently 65 slides here. Part of the reason for that is that I was told no movies, so some of them are going to be gone through rather rapidly, so don't get worried too much. So auroras are something that we all know. Only if we have some recent arrivals who live in a city are they likely to have been in Alberta and not to have seen auroras. This one is actually from the Lethbridge area, so even as far south as Lethbridge, you can get quite nice auroras. In fact, it's under conditions of high activity that you tend to get auroras a bit more to the south, and so when you do get them further south, they tend to be rather spectacular. So the auroras have been known, we know at least since Roman times, because we have reports from written records of unusual lights in the sky that can only be interpreted as being auroras. However, it's only about 100 years ago that scientific study of the auroras started. In fact, almost exactly 100 years ago, research was underway in Norway, which was the first to prove that auroras were higher than the local mountains. So they were thought of as an atmospheric phenomenon that wasn't necessarily particularly high. Some of the earliest auroral observatories were built on the top of mountains in Norway at huge expense for the time, and that was in the thought that they might be able to look down on the auroras or triangulate them in some way from those mountaintops. Now we know that that's a futile effort, since they're at least 10 times higher than the highest mountains. I will mention the International Polar Year. We are in another International Polar Year right now that seems to have taken a long time getting started, and we have applied for funding for some interesting projects for the Polar Year, and we'll hope to get that. Now, following in the line of International Polar Years, the last notable International Polar Year had its name actually changed to International Geophysical Year. So in Alberta, when people say the word geophysics, at least most people know the word, but they tend to think of it as something to do with oil fields. In fact, geophysics includes the study of all of the things entouring the Earth, including near space, where, for example, the Van Allen radiation belts exist, and where in the magnetic tail of the Earth that I'll talk about shortly, the auroras are activated. Now, until now, we've had the problem that everybody knows the story of the study of the elephant by the five or six, in this case, I guess, blind men, and each of them has a different interpretation. Well, until now, or until recently, we have had effectively only one man to study the elephant with, and whatever his sensory deficiencies. So it was a big problem to try and figure out what was going on. So it was thought that with constellations of satellites, of which two major ones are Cluster and Themis, both of which I'll talk about later, that many of the answers would be found. But I'm afraid that all we've done is that we have advanced from having one blind man to now having five or six, and we know that in the story that actually didn't work that well either. So we may need yet more satellites, even though we have constellations of them now. So one of the interesting developments, and one that was spurred quite a bit by Canadian efforts at the University of Calgary, is auroral imaging from space. Now, one of the huge advantages of being in space is that you can use other types of light than the familiar light that we have, and in particular you can use ultraviolet light, which does not penetrate the atmosphere. Now that's a good thing because you'd get quite the suntan pretty darn quickly on a sunny day if ultraviolet light of this wavelength was able to get through the atmosphere. But it is a bad thing also because it doesn't allow us to study things that emit ultraviolet light that are outside the atmosphere. For example, many stars have important emissions of ultraviolet light, and it turns out so do the auroras. So with the launch of satellites that could image the ultraviolet light, it is possible to see that the auroras in fact encircle the globe completely. And this is only visible from the surface in very rare circumstances. You can see that this part of the image is slightly brighter, and in fact the sun direction is in this direction. And you'll notice that the auroras seem to be the most active in the direction opposite in space to the sun. So we'll come back to one of the meanings of that in a moment, but also pay attention to the fact that there is a little flare-up of auroras there. But then a few minutes later, well, actually more like an hour and a half later, but there's been a big flare-up, and you can see that the entire night side of the Earth has these bright auroras. In fact, I'll go back just so you can compare. So there was just a little active area around midnight, midnight being the direction exactly opposite to the sun. And then not that much later, the entire night side had these very active and bright auroras. So this is called a substorm, and I will not tell you why it's called a substorm and what storms are. There's not enough time for that. But I will use the term substorms later, so I just want you to know that. So this flare-up of auroras is called a substorm, and you see that it covers the Earth on a continental scale on the night side. Now, of course, the origin of all this is the sun, which I'm seeing as rather flattened and squashed and looking like an egg here. I don't know how it shows up on other people's screens, but it is actually extremely round, and it is in association with sunspots and active regions on the sun that we often get auroras. And so one problem and reason that there have not been very many auroras recently, strictly speaking, is that we have been at what's called solar minimum. So there have been no sunspots, And you can see by this photo that that is true. It was taken on February 2nd, 2008. And the type of activity that produces sunspots also produces auroras. So we've been in kind of a dearth of auroras recently. Now, the sunspots themselves do not cause the aurora, but associated with the general magnetic activity of the sun is something called coronal mass ejections. Unfortunately, for the presentation, I had to take some rather spectacular movies out of this presentation, but you'll notice that I've given a URL here, and it probably won't be here long enough for you to copy out the whole thing, but if you just get the first part, soho.www.nascom.nasa.gov, then you'll be able to go and look for movies on your own, and they're pretty spectacular. This is from a satellite called SOHO, which is poised between the Earth and the Sun and points at the Sun so that it can continuously monitor the Sun. Now, this little image of the Sun has been superimposed. The whole idea of SOHO is to block out the Sun so that the faint outer atmosphere known as the corona can be seen. And indeed, you can see that this outer atmosphere, normally you can get the impression that it normally flows out from the Sun, and that is true. When it flows out, it is known as the solar wind, but it doesn't always do so regularly. It sometimes has explosions, and these explosions are called coronal mass ejections. So if one of these comes towards us, this can set conditions up to produce auroras. You can well imagine that a big ball of gas like that, and it also has magnetic fields in it which store energy, so there is energy stored there, and then that is what energizes the auroras if it comes towards us. This particular one, by the way, would be seen going out to the side, and so it would not be coming towards us, and it is in fact fairly difficult to see the ones that are coming straight towards us because they're sort of coming straight towards us. And it's sort of like a deer in the headlights sort of thing. This particular slide is much better as a movie. You can't even see the coronal mass ejection in this slide anymore, I'm sorry. But at that website you can see them. Another thing that happens, maybe rather hard to see on your screen, and in the movie there get to be a lot more of them, but there are energetic particles that are shot off when these coronal mass ejections or solar flares, which can be related to them, go off. So a few of these things you see are stars. A few of them are caused by highly energetic particles being shot towards the Earth. Now, I did mention the sunspot cycle. So since shortly after the invention of the telescope, and don't do this at home, don't point your telescope towards the sun and try and have a look. You need to use safe viewing techniques. However, early on, it was discovered that if you pointed a telescope towards the sun and counted the sunspots and kept track of it for years, there was the discovery that they came and went. So, as I mentioned, we have recently, in approximately 2008, been right down near the minimum of this solar cycle, and it's up near the maximum that you see auroras. So the Themis satellites are up there now. They have kind of gone through this minimal period where last fall it was kind of holding our breath. Are we ever going to get anything? But we're starting to get things, and then we'll head up hopefully fairly rapidly to the point where we have a lot of auroras to study and, of course, to enjoy. So let's talk about some physics. We have relatively low attendance, and so about half of the audience are physicists, so maybe I can get away with a little bit of physics. One of the fundamental points behind auroras is that energy can be stored in gas and in magnetic fields. The typical example of storage of energy in gas, I just recently bought a compressor, and you can imagine that if you can run a staple gun and a chisel and everything, that's all running on compressed gas. So gas can store energy, and magnetic field storage of energy is not maybe as common, but it does happen temporarily, at least in all motors which run on electricity. Now, one of the myths that people think is true is that auroras are caused by these particles, I mentioned particles earlier, coming directly from the sun. But you'll recall that I showed you in the satellite photographs, and people do know this from their experience, that auroras are seen at night. So if they were caused by particles coming from the sun straight towards the Earth, you would expect auroras to in fact be strongest on the day side of the Earth. But they are not directly caused by that. What they are caused by is this solar wind that I discussed earlier interacting with Earth's magnetic field, and this causes a tail to be formed behind the Earth, and that energy can be stored there in the gas and in the magnetic fields that are in this magnetic tail. And so here the scale has been a little bit changed from what is reality, because if this was reality, when you looked up, you'd see almost the whole sky covered with the sun. So they've kind of cut a little bit in this region and made things a little closer to the sun than they really are. But basically what is happening is the solar wind is streaming out, and it is pushing back gas around the Earth and interacting with the magnetic field to compress the magnetic field on this side and to pull it out into a tail. And you can usefully think of this as being sort of like a comet. So it's all stretched out on the back side. And that is in fact where the energy that will form the northern lights is stored, and that is why we see them at night and not during the day. Although, as I mentioned, they're there to some degree during the day as well. Now, the process that allows both the storage of the energy and then its release later on to form auroras is called magnetic reconnection. And this is a topic of a large amount of research at the moment, but there's every empirical evidence that although we do not completely understand the process, that it basically does happen. So basically there's reconnection at the front side that allows magnetic field and gas to be taken into the back side and stored there, and at a later time reconnection will allow that energy, mostly the magnetic energy, to be converted into gas energy that flows in towards the Earth and causes the northern lights. So if everything happens in exactly the right sequence, then we get an aurora. So this is, I've always fantasized about going and sitting in a hot spring and watching auroras. Some of these days I'll make it up to Alaska to do that. So what are some of the basic facts? I've already belabored the fact that the best time to see auroras is at night. And in fact, when there's not much auroral activity, near midnight is the best time, the very best time. From Athabasca, and I'm not sure if we have anybody besides the research center who's actually in Athabasca. Where is Audrey? In Edmonton. Okay, so we don't have too many Athabascans tuned in. But from Athabasca, you can see an aurora just about every night. And you have to turn towards the northern horizon, and we can see far enough north that we're seeing basically auroras over Yellowknife, and there's an aurora almost every night. Now, it won't be very impressive most of the time, but basically in Athabasca near midnight, almost all the time you see an aurora. When there's a lot of auroral activity, the auroras can be seen in the evening and can last into the morning as well. And that corresponds to, in the much earlier satellite picture I showed you, it had spread over the entire night side of the Earth, which meant that you could see it in the evening or the morning. Auroras are green in color for the most part, and that comes from oxygen emissions, and that's at about 100 kilometers altitude. It's very similar to the emission from a fluorescent light bulb or from a neon tube in front of a restaurant. So that neon tube idea also explains how you can get different colors, because they change the gases and they change the pressure in neon tubes to get different colors. And so there are different colors in the aurora. Purple is sometimes at the lower boundary of the aurora caused by nitrogen, and red that is higher up comes from oxygen, much like the green does, but it comes from oxygen higher up and at a lower pressure. So another fact is that whatever is coming in to energize the giving off of light, called fluorescence, also allows us to say some things about what particles are coming from space. Now, the physicists will be happy I've got an equation here, but other people don't need to worry about the equation. This is data from Minook near Athabasca. It's from a rather large event that took place before we had a magnetometer in Athabasca. We got one about a year after this. And this simply shows a baseline level of magnetic fields. And then as this auroral event went on, there was quite a bit of change in the magnetic field, hundreds of nanoteslas, we call it, and to nano sounds very small, but to magnetic field people, they would know that that's relatively a fairly large change in the magnetic field. So to study the Northern Lights at Athabasca University, we use instruments called magnetometers, and these magnetometers, sorry, I gave this talk in Lethbridge, so I'm pointing out that we have a magnetometer there. We also have one in Calgary, Red Deer, had one in Edmonton, and have several in Athabasca. So we can measure the magnetic field, and auroras give off a magnetic field because there are electric currents in them. Now, the study of the auroras seems to be very romantic, and here's a beautiful picture. I hope it comes through with some justice on your screen. It's not so great here in the room at ELC, so maybe those at home will be enjoying it more. But a beautiful aurora and sort of poetic details that were posted on spaceweather.com, which is a website I highly recommend. This guy was very excited about this beautiful aurora that he saw, but unfortunately scientists are more excited by seeing this graph than by seeing that beautiful picture. So this graph again shows changes in the magnetic field, and this guy had recorded the time he had taken it, and he'd taken it just about this time, which is when the magnetic field was changing the most. So that's what allows us to do some actual studies of the magnetic field. So we do measure them in Athabasca. This is the last 24 hours of changes in the magnetic field. Nothing particularly exciting going on. You can see that there were some pulsations seen a little bit earlier today. But other than that, this is what we would call a relatively quiet day. In fact, you can see in this portion variations that are caused by the heating of our own atmosphere. So those are relatively small effects. When you get a big aurora, you can get hundreds on the scale here. This is 20 right here, and a big aurora will cause hundreds. So that would be, you know, something on this scale that would be rather big. So we monitor continuously. This is actually from much earlier in the year, week one, week two, week three, etc. Monitoring going on by our project in Lethbridge, and you can see that in the early part of the year things were relatively boring, and then just before I gave the talk in Lethbridge it turned out there had been a big aurora, and that corresponds to this dip in the magnetic field. So we're continuously monitoring this, and then we can try and interpret this data to understand the Northern Lights. Now, one of the reasons for understanding the Northern Lights is not simply curiosity. It is, in fact, because there are practical aspects, most of them bad, to the Northern Lights. And so one of the most important things that actually happens is that there are currents, electrical currents, that flow in the ionosphere, which is about 100 kilometers above our heads. And those electrical currents, if they change very quickly, they can actually broadcast basically electricity. And that can be detected by power grids that act like antennas. And the very famous case was in Quebec in 1989. The entire Hydro-Quebec grid was knocked out by these changing magnetic fields that show up as electric fields in their power grids. The power grid acts like a very large antenna and picks this stuff up. Another large system that we have here in Alberta is pipelines. And these are large structures that also act as antennas for this. And the effects are not as dramatic. We will never see pipelines blowing up because of auroras changing. But what does happen is corrosion in the pipelines. So the actual cost of the Northern Lights in Alberta is in the millions or tens of millions of dollars a year. It's just like, much like your car might slowly be rusting away, it's not very dramatic. The pipelines are being degraded, but at a fairly slow rate. Nevertheless, we would like to understand how this pipeline corrosion happens and measure it as it proceeds. Other things that can happen, I don't know how much people tuned in. I guess we have one French professor. So one very sad event was about 10 years ago. We lost one of our French channels on TV. And that actually happened because energetic electrons damaged the ANIC satellite to the point that they had to cut something. And in Alberta, unfortunately, one of the lesser watched shows was this French channel. So I think we've got more French channels back now with the growth of channels. But space weather affects everybody's life. So we did actually lose, this is not a made up story, we lost a French channel due to the Northern Lights. So other bad effects can happen as well. And about the only good effect is that sometimes you get to see a beautiful aurora. There can be an effect on compasses. So compasses rely on the orderly magnetic field of the Earth, and you don't need to bother with the right-hand diagram. Basically, the compass points north because it tries to line up with the magnetic field of the Earth. Here's a case of a very dramatic event. Now, this is fairly far north. You've possibly heard of stories of explorers where the compass doesn't point in the right direction and then they go out in the cold and they die. Well, this is from Iqaluit, so it is fairly far north, but this arrow shows the normal position of the magnetic field. And under those conditions, at Iqaluit, your compass does point north, so you can reliably use your compass to go out. However, during this rather large magnetic event, which was a big aurora, the effect of the current associated with the aurora was actually to reverse locally the direction of the magnetic field. So if you went out and used your compass and said, hey, I'm going to go north, and it's a dark night and it's stormy and, you know, good thing I have this compass so I can know where I'm going, you're going to head straight south as you think you're heading north, with probably bad consequences. By October in Iqaluit, you don't want to be caught outside already in the cold. Now, as I mentioned, power failure effects did take place in 1989 in Quebec. An interesting aspect is that this is a calculation of where the problems were, in fact, the biggest. And the red area is where the worst problems were. Now, you'll notice that that happens to be centered just about on Alberta, and it's not centered on Quebec. And yet it's in Quebec that all the damage took place. The reason for that is that our power grids are, in general, very small, and they do not pick up the problem from the auroras nearly as much. In Quebec, they've built a lot of generating capacity in this region near Hudson's Bay and the James Bay Project, and then they send that power quite far south to sell it. So there's a huge antenna, is what you want to look at it. They call it a power grid. But for auroras, it's an antenna. And it got blown up by this event. Whereas in Alberta, you know, Genesee is not very far from Edmonton, so there's not a big problem here. Although, as I say, the big thing you do have here is pipelines, and they just corrode quietly and cost you money that you don't even know about. So how do we actually study the Northern Lights? We study various things from the ground, their motion and forms, as I mentioned, the magnetic fields. We can do detailed analysis of their light. And I guess I did give this talk in Quebec, so I've still got an accent on the E. We can study their effects on GPS, which can be a bad effect, like almost all the effects, and then putting satellites in place. Now, there is an upcoming Canadian satellite called Cassiope EPOP, but this talk is mainly about Themis. So let's move along towards that. However, let's just mention why Themis has a strong relationship with Canada. Canada is well placed for studying the Northern Lights. These two black lines are the lines of geomagnetic latitude, and the auroras tend to follow those, and most auroras tend to be near this one. And then when there's activity of a stronger nature, it expands to basically fill this region. This is Athabasca. So you notice that much of Canada is very well placed for studying the Northern Lights, and the settled regions of Canada include the prairies, which have many places that are very well placed, and we just happen to be about the best because combination of roads, etc. It's been very difficult to put magnetometers in Quebec because this region of Quebec is largely undeveloped. You'll notice that where most of the population of Canada lives, they do not, in fact, see the Northern Lights nearly as much as we do. So, for a combination of reasons, until 2004, there was only one magnetometer in Quebec, at a place called Poste de la Madeleine. And it has been very important for research purposes to get more magnetometers in Quebec. So since 2004, and in particular last year, I have been heavily involved in getting more magnetometers placed, and there are now all of these orange dots are magnetometers in Quebec. Now what's not shown here is the one at Poste de la Madeleine is actually gone, and it's on the Belcher Islands over here. But they've lost one and gained a whole bunch. So our setup for studying the Northern Lights on a Canadian scale is very greatly improved in recent years, and the motivation for that has largely been getting ready for Themis. So there's Themis going up. All the five satellites, of which you could see three in the first slide, went up on one rocket, so you can imagine that the guy in charge was sweating bullets as this happened, but it all went perfectly, and the five satellites were placed in orbit on the 17th of February. Sadly enough, I was there on the 16th of February and had to leave, and the launch was delayed by one day. I believe, Igor, you saw the launch, right? You had to leave too? Oh, okay. So we score zero here for people having seen the launch. I was told later that it wasn't actually as spectacular as you might think, but who knows? I would have liked to have seen it. Anyway, the five Themis satellites have been placed with three near the Earth, and then basically you should regard one of those as also forming part of a line extending away from the Earth. And in that way, we're trying to resolve whether something happens way back far from the Earth, and then an aurora gets triggered at the Earth, or whether in fact the triggering is very near the Earth, and then something travels backwards. So it's a fundamental aspect of our lack of understanding of the auroras that we don't even know where they start. And sadly enough, after one winter in orbit, I would still say that Themis has not just given the instant answer to that question. The answer that the people who launched Themis wanted to find is true part of the time. And work done here, including by Igor Voronkov, who's in the audience, has tended to show that the answer they didn't want to find also happens. So things remain a little bit unclear. So we may need yet more studies. It didn't answer it in a definitive way. But nevertheless, the idea is to use three near the Earth to make sure things aren't going sideways, and then three aligned this way to see if things are going backwards or forwards. And we still don't actually know the answer. There has been a big importance, however, as I mentioned, of Canada, because the lineup that you saw of the Themis satellites, and I'll come back to this later, happens every 4 days, and it was the orbits were designed so that this happens over Canada. And I know somebody wanted to leave, so it's now 3:30, so I won't be offended. Although you're going to miss the good stuff, but get a little distracted there. So one of the major projects for Canada was to install cameras all across the country so that the auroras could be photographed on a continental scale that Canada allows us to do. So Eric Donovan in the University of Calgary has been the principal investigator of the ground-based part of THEMIS in Canada. And what I'm going to show you is four quick slides that I'll go through, but there are big changes that you'll see in the Aurora. And these big changes happened on the scale of Canada in 1 minute. So the Aurora can be very dynamic. So there's this situation just before the Aurora went off, and the lettering of the time is too small for you to read. So that's why I'm emphasizing that what I'm going to show you all happens in 1 minute. You can see that there's some brightening there, and that is in fact where the Aurora will go off. So there it's just gone off, and that's just 15 seconds later. There is 15 seconds yet later. You can see that there's all kinds of activity along this line, which extends from eastern Manitoba to the Northwest Territories, so it's a couple of thousand kilometers long. And there, after 1 minute, exactly 1 minute later, there's a very bright and active aurora across that whole range. So the aurora can really explode, and these explosions are what are called substorms. Now, in 2002, we got funding for building the Athabasca University Geophysical Observatory. This shows it being constructed with an aurora in the background. You notice how dark the background is, and I will lament about that later. One of the important aspects of the observatory has been very good communications. This is a bundle of fiber optics hanging there waiting to be attached to the observatory. With that, we can control all of the instrumentation in the observatory. So having an automated observatory was a very important thing. So one of the things we participated early on was the University of Calgary tested the cameras for NASA for the ground portion of THEMIS, and this is one of those cameras under test, approximately 2003. We later also tested the outdoor enclosures that are used for them under winter conditions. And I would like to show you what an aurora typically looks like as it develops at Athabasca. This would be a typical development actually further north. It doesn't happen to this degree at Athabasca that often, but this is a case in February. So basically this is over less than an hour. So this is the development if you're in Athabasca or in a dark place in Edmonton with a clear northern horizon. You can see to the north some sort of a brightening on the horizon. And eventually that will move further south. So that means it'll move more overhead coming towards you. But it will still just be a fuzzy arc, what's called a homogeneous arc. And then you'll notice that it has moved a little further south in this one, just a little. And here it's almost at the overhead point, which is in the middle of the image. And then at some point, that will suddenly break up into curtains of auroras. And that's what you see here. It's kind of like looking up curtains these are vertical structures, auroral rays that are standing vertically, and in the image this is what they look like. And then very quickly after that happens, that's 5:38 UT, which is near midnight, and then 2 minutes later the whole sky is filled with very bright auroras. So this is typical of what we would see at Athabasca under pretty active conditions. So if you want to know if there's going to be an aurora, if you do see something up north and it's getting a little brighter, chances are you're going to see a dramatic aurora. It's just you may have to wait a little while. I mentioned the THEMIS orbits, and I'll just do this very quickly. They're designed so that every 4 days you get this lining up over Canada. And then this is another auroral event on February 2nd, 2008, as recorded at Athabasca. And as I mentioned, this is many, many of those little round images, which are images of the whole sky that I showed you before, similar to what I showed you before. So this is the northern horizon at the top. And you'll notice that as time goes on, as you go through these, time goes on, it first was just a little sliver, sort of like a fingernail up at the top, and then it's growing more and more, coming further south and filling more of the sky. A curious phenomenon, which is actually pretty visible in this event, is that before the aurora actually gets bright, this arc that had been there fades. So this seems to be a good example of that. And then it will suddenly brighten. So you can see here it suddenly brightens. And that is what's called the auroral onset. So that is the start of the substorm. Now, the interest in studying this for Themis, from Eric Donovan's project, you'll recall that I said that it goes southward as seen from Athabasca. Well, with Eric's project, you can tell that this happened over all of Canada. So Athabasca is in the center of this one. We contribute to Themis this image, but there are many other cameras across Canada run by Eric Donovan. And then you'll notice there's a band of auroras which is up in the Northwest Territories. So this is now 10 minutes later. You'll notice that it has come further south. 10 minutes later, it has come yet further south, and this would be starting to be well in the field of view of our imager. And then it's yet further south. So now this corresponds to what I showed you before. It's really moved into the field of view for us. And then now it's yet brighter and further south, and bam, there by that time it has gone off, and this so-called breakup has happened, and it sort of does look like things got broken, but that was the substorm going off. So this is the advantage of this camera network for Themis. It allows us to see everything that's going on. Now, you may have noticed that over in the east, it was cloudy, so you can't really see too much going on in the east. It maybe looks like the coast was clear over here, but most of these ones were not. So you are still at the mercy of clouds when you're imaging from the ground, but most of Western Canada was clear for this event. Now, as I mentioned, we try to line this up with what's going on in space, and I will not go into any detail at all, except to tell you that this particular curve going up means that the substorm had gone off, and that at the same time, the Themis spacecraft show important changes in the magnetic field, which is shown here, and it's less easy to see, but there are important changes in the plasma in space, the gas that's in space. So that's a seen at one Themis, and then rather similar changes are seen at another Themis. Of course, the devil is in the details, and the differences between those Themises will allow us to tell a lot about what happened during that particular aurora. Now, to change the topic quite a bit, Themis is, as I mentioned, lined up in the tail of the Earth. It turns out that that happens in the winter in Canada, and so right now Themis is not in the tail of the Earth because the Themis orbit stays fixed in space, but the Earth goes around the Sun, and so the Themis orbit is not particularly useful right now for studying auroras. There is another project called Cluster, of which this is the orbit, which is about an opposite orbit to Themis. In some ways that's unfortunate. And so we've also used Cluster at a different time of year. It moves into the active tail of the Earth, and we've done some studies, particularly last year, although Rob Lerner this year is working on it further, to study this active region behind the Earth using these multiple European satellites called Cluster. And one of the things that we can study is the actual geometry of the magnetic field in that region behind the Earth, so we can fit theoretical values to it. You can see that the black is the data and the red is the fitting of the theoretical curve, and it actually fits pretty well. So to some degree we have some understanding of that magnetic tail, but we still have some questions that we're trying to answer. And an interesting thing called flapping happens, and all I really want you to take away from this slide is that there are four curves here. It may be hard to see in the room, but it looks like kind of a multicolored curve. The reason is that there's each spacecraft has a different colored curve. So these four spacecraft allow us to study the magnetic field in different places at the same time. And you'll notice that for the most part they overlap, but there was a period here when they were quite different, and we can use that theoretical curve to understand where the spacecraft were and the structure back there at that time. Now, let's come back to Earth and in particular talk about the sad story of Athabasca University Geophysical Observatory. Now, if you go out in space, and this is assembled actually from many satellite overpasses, but if you went far enough out and had a telescope, you could look back and you could see the pattern of lights from North America. And not surprisingly, the entire coastline of the United States is very well outlined by these lights. And then you can see that there's a darker area here in Texas near the Mexican border. And then you get back to the other coast, and it's also extremely well outlined. The Canada-US border is not particularly obvious, but we have the Great Plains here and lots of farmland and no big cities and no big sources of light. This big source of light is Calgary, and this is Edmonton, including the adjacent gas flaring and things like that that produce light. So the bottom line is that we're producing an awful lot of light, mainly in our cities, that is going off into space and being wasted. So if we have an energy crisis, well, there's where a lot of energy is going. Now the bad thing about that is that it actually lights up our skies to the point that even somebody living in Edmonton, where we do have fairly active auroras, young people here may never have seen them because there's simply too much garbage light in the skies. Now Athabasca is right up here at the edge, and therefore it seemed a good idea to build an auroral observatory there because it was a dark area. Unfortunately, fortunately we did build the observatory, but it was not anticipated that it would get light pollution as badly as it has, as quickly as it has. So it was founded in 2002. Actually, UCLA gave us a magnetometer nearly 10 years ago, so we had a magnetometer in 1998. And this is a picture of our small building, so people may have seen it in Athabasca. It's now surrounded by a fence. And it also has a second dome. We were fortunate in 2005 that Japanese colleagues were quite interested in coming and putting equipment there, and so this is us transporting some of their equipment. So they practically doubled the amount of instruments that we had at the observatory. Another nice thing about working with the Japanese is they're extremely energetic, and so we've been doing measurements for many years and trying to publish the results, and they've been doing measurements since 2005 and written quite a number of papers on the results, so, and some quite interesting results. So it's very nice to be working with them. This, for example, it supposedly means good luck in Japanese. And indeed, while they were still here, we had a very unusual aurora. And within the first couple of days of operation of their instruments, we were able to measure characteristics of this proton aurora. So hopefully you can see the building of our observatory is at the bottom, and then this is this unusual aurora that they were lucky enough to be able to photograph. It was mostly cloudy while they were here, but while it was clear, they got exactly what they were looking for, this unusual type of aurora, and are writing a paper about this that happened 2 days after they installed their instruments. My luck has not been quite so good. In any case, the problem is that this was, when you're looking north, this was previously our horizon. And so exceptionally good, since we're normally to the south of the aurora, it was exceptionally good for seeing the aurora to the north of us. This is a 60-watt light bulb a half a kilometer away. So with sensitive equipment, this is what you can detect, and this was our main source of light. So that just illustrates that it was very dark. This is a rather long exposure with the camera. Now the multiplex is located here and has literally thousands of watts of light. So this has basically put us out of business. It was anticipated that this would happen, but it wasn't anticipated how quickly it would happen. So this is basically, if you have $1 million worth of instruments and it's very sensitive to light, and you put a huge amount of light, this is the multiplex, and you see the streaking, what you cannot see is the general loss of sensitivity due to all this light. So basically, this is the unusual blue auroras. It doesn't seem to be as degraded, but some of the other colors are very degraded by these lights being there. So we have to move the observatory, and basically the quest for darkness. So this is a topographic map, and this is Athabasca. The hopeful thing when you look at this map, though, is that there's a lot of empty land still in Athabasca County, so it should be possible to find another site. Another thing that has developed quite a bit since 2002 is that you can go anywhere in Athabasca County now and get wireless high-speed internet. So our need to control the instruments can be met by wireless internet. So the basic conclusions, we're participating in some interesting spacecraft studies and contributing ground data that's very valuable to combine with those spacecraft, so both Themis and Cluster. And I didn't really mention Double Star, but that works with them as well. And the question is, we maybe are on the doorstep of finally understanding the Northern Lights. Will finally understanding the Northern Lights diminish our appreciation of their beauty? Thank you. So I guess we now open the floor for questions, and Kathy hopefully can handle all this complicated equipment for me.
Thank you. The people online are clapping. We'll take questions from the people online first, and then the people in the room. So if anyone online has a question, would you either send it via the text box or go ahead and try to use your mic? Go ahead, Maria. Maria asks, is there a classification of auroras?
Okay. The answer is yes, there is a classification of auroras. For example, I referred to the arc that you would see before the activation as a homogeneous arc. So these types of general visual descriptions are used. There have been attempts, for example, at the University of Calgary to apply machine vision techniques and to do a much more sophisticated analysis. We tend not to use the old visual classification very much anymore.
Anybody else online? Well, we can come back to you. How about the physicist in the room? Would you just press your mic and then everyone can hear you?
Yeah. So, do we experience problems with moving observatory, and what's possible solution you think will be?
Well, of course, the ideal situation would be to keep the current observatory, and one of the nice things about it is it's on fiber optic cable, so we will never be able to get that speed in the foreseeable future again. But basically, with the light situation being what it is, we have to move it. So the first stage that I'm going through is applying for grants to be able to afford to move it. And then hopefully this winter, by October, we should know about the grants. And then the moving would actually take place next year. I'd hope to do it this year because obviously it would be nice to contribute to Themis better by not having light pollution, but it's not possible to do it this year.
Are there any instruments that are in the observatory right now that are still going to be useful even though there's all this new light pollution?
Yeah, we have been working on magnetic instruments up there, and recently this has been going extremely well. So we have low-cost magnetic instruments, and these are not very affected by light pollution. Sadly enough, our most sensitive magnetometer by the Japanese is affected by vibration, and the multiplex construction affected it a lot. So we have to assess whether just the general increase in traffic will affect it. But most of our magnetic instruments do not need to be moved, which is a good thing because they're a pain to move. They need to be dug up, and maybe people aren't going to want to be my summer student next year.
Maria has another question. How predictable are the auroras?
That's actually a good question. There are many time scales of predictability. So I mentioned one of them in the talk, which is that if you see a homogeneous arc and it's moving towards you and brightening, then you're probably going to get an aurora within an hour or so, and you just have to be patient. The other thing that can give you some prediction on an hour or so timescale is to know that the solar wind is what ultimately drives the activity. And we have satellites. I showed the solar images from the SOHO satellite. There are other satellites also located between the Sun and the Earth which detect the solar wind. And they can tell us if the conditions in the solar wind are good for causing an aurora. And so if you look at those satellites, you can get about an hour's lead time on when the conditions are good. And then usually it would take about an hour for the energy to get stored and then to come out. So you get about a 2-hour predictability that way. The other way that would be ideal is if you can see these coronal mass ejections. As I mentioned, that's actually rather difficult to see. And then you would get about a 3-day predictability. So that's about the level of predictability that you could have with any great accuracy. Another degree of predictability is that, as seen from the Earth, the Sun takes around a month to rotate. And so if there's been an active region that caused auroras, in about a month, chances are that you'll be in that same position again. So there's sort of some degree of predictability on a month scale. And then, of course, on the 11-year cycle, you know that you're going to get a lot less auroras at the minimum, and that was certainly the case this past winter. So there are many different scales of predictability, and the reliability of predictability depends on those scales also.
Actually, I have a comment. Martin forgot to mention that you can see auroras all around Canada in real time through the internet.
On the Themis site, you mean?
On the Themis site and on the site of University of Calgary.
That's a good point. So for those who are interested, the Themis site is themis.sprl, I think I'm getting that right, .berkeley.edu. Of course, the best way is just to go Google Themis Berkeley. And then could you tell us what the other site is?
I don't remember. Just go
Themis to University of Calgary, Google that, and you can get these. Thanks for the comment.
So with respect to predictability, whether or not you're going to see aurora, you can see if it moves like west toward Athabasca or it moves south toward Athabasca. So
another thing with regard to predictability, there are websites that do give predictions. One of them is called spaceweather.com, and the other one is spaceweather.ca. And they both give different types of forecasts, but they do give alerts and forecasts.
once a long time ago in October in Prince Rupert on the coast of BC, I saw an aurora that was completely red, and I think it's the only one I've ever seen that was like that. So that would be your high elevation oxygen that would give you like a blood red aurora.
Yes, those are very memorable, and despite many, many years of watching the skies, I had never seen one until maybe 4 or 5 years ago. By chance, I phoned my colleague, who's an astronomer, and I got him actually in his observatory, and he said, "Oh yeah, I know you're calling to tell me about the bright red aurora." I said, "What? What bright red aurora?" And I ran up the stairs and caught this bright red aurora, and it was totally amazing because not only was the whole sky blood red, but the whole sky was pulsating, and pretty amazing to see. The only time that I've actually seen that. You can typically see the red if you actually look above the green. The red is higher up, and you'll see it often above the green, but the whole sky being blood red, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I thought so, and I was shepherding a whole undergraduate biology field trip, so I didn't get to properly appreciate it at the time. We were trying to keep people from drowning in the intertidal while this wonderful red aurora was going on.
I've noticed a lot that you can see them in the wintertime. Is that just coincidence? I mean, from what you've said, it's the activity levels and the cycle that makes the difference. It's not the seasons that make the difference.
The basic best answer to that question is that at this latitude and at latitudes further north where you can see a lot of aurora, there's a huge difference in how dark it is between the summer and the winter. So you need darkness to see them, and so you will see them a lot more in the winter. In theory, and I think some people disagree with this theory, and I'm looking at Igor because I seem to recall discussing with him, and he doesn't like this theory too much, if I recall correctly. In theory, the best time to see them is by an effect called the Russell-McFerrin effect, and the best time is around the spring and the fall. But at our latitude, that's whatever small effect is due to that is by far overcome by the effect of, it hardly will get dark tonight, for example. You'll see them more in the winter. I think a secondary effect that at these latitude or in this area is probably still more important than the Russell-McFerrin effect is that it is more cloudy in the summer here, and you can get long spells of clear weather in the winter. Although I must admit, last winter was a particularly cloudy winter, but it didn't really hurt Themis too much because there was hardly any aurora anyway. So we're hoping for better next winter, a more typical winter.
Just a question about how the Themis data is gathered. It's all automated, but how often do you sit down and look at it, or do you have to send it off? Do you guys talk to each other about it, or how does that all work?
Well, we, of course, talk to each other quite a bit. There is a website where you can access it. I think that Themis has been a model of free data access. It's very sad and ironic that at this time that Themis is pioneering so much free data access, we found that conditions in Canada are so hostile that we have had to shut down our data access, and on the premise that the harder you make data to get, the more people are going to try and get it and therefore help you. But in general, Themis has been a model for what I believe in, even though ironically I can't put it into practice, which is sharing data. The data is all available on the Themis Berkeley website, and every week they have a telephone conference to discuss what projects people are working on using that data. So there's quite a bit of activity going on right now. I would say that the principal investigator of Themis has shown the way to do good collaborative science in several ways. He has hundreds of millions of dollars of funding, so he can kind of afford it to give away the data.
You talk about 11-year cycle for the sunspots.
Yes.
Is there any understanding of that? What's the research on that?
Oh, well, that's a very good question. That's an entirely different domain. It has to do, of course, with magnetic fields and the gas of the sun, but it's actually something I wouldn't say that I know a lot about. It's an active research area, and I think I'm just going to beg off and say it's very poorly understood, but very well observed.
Another quick question. I know there's been a controversy about whether or not auroras really crackle, and I haven't heard them ever. Many northern residents report that they do, lots of scientific efforts to record any possible crackling or to understand mechanisms that have not turned up data. Do you have any comments about aurora crackling?
That's a good question also, because it is very widely reported. And there has to date been no recording of such a noise. But there are a couple of factors there. One is that human hearing is actually pretty sensitive. So there are theories that there might be ways to make this happen near the surface of the Earth without sound coming down directly. So we can pretty well prove that it's impossible for sound to come directly from the auroras, but there might be ways for other things to make sound happen near the surface of the Earth at the time when an aurora is going on. So that's one of the theories. Another theory is that if you actually see something happening and you don't hear a sound, and you're used to hearing a sound when something flashes in the night or something, your brain will supply the missing sound. So there is a psychological theory also. You know, if you see a car crash and you didn't hear a noise, most witnesses later would say that they did hear the noise. It's a debated topic. I will note that there was a similar question with meteors. There's something called anomalous sound of meteors. And it was poo-pooed. It was said that it was impossible and therefore it didn't exist. But about 10 years ago, it was in fact recorded.
Uh-huh.
So I don't really know. And this is the type of question that, although it's quite intriguing, it's very difficult to get any research money for. So actually seeing an answer is not likely in the near future.
A friend whose brother was doing astrophysics or something at the U of C, and that was one of his research topics about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Should we do a last call online? Okay, consider this to be a last call online. I notice Maria has gone. A question looks like from Graham. Is that a question or is that? No questions. Okay.
Thank you very much. That was very, very entertaining and also enlightening.
Thank you. I saw some new Themis events by preparing for this talk. Graham, help!